streets are screaming now. They brought death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our...
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Divisions. Okay, today I'm going solo again, and I want to address this question of austerity. Why austerity, economic programs, why austerity? We see austerity all across the globe, in the Eurozone, particularly in Southern Europe. Now it's beginning to occur, IMF deals in the Ukraine, in Japan, and in the U.S. Why, after 5 years, do policymakers still follow this topic or this policy of austerity? Okay, first let's define what we mean by that, because sometimes it's confused. And then we'll talk about the examples and the role it plays. But before I get into that, I want to say a few preliminary words on the show next week. The show next week is going to be in the wake of the midterm elections. Okay, we know it was a debacle, and we know 9 Senate seats were gained by the Republicans. And there's a good chance they'll get the 10th here with the runoff election in Louisiana. And that means they'll have 54 votes in the Senate when they didn't even have a majority last time. So it's a Democratic debacle predicted by yours truly several months ago as a continuation of the shellacking, as President Obama said, he got in 2010 in the House. All right, so, but what's important is not simply to analyze the midterm elections next week in a little more depth than it's done to date, but to focus and emphasize what's coming. Ah, well, what's coming is Back to the Future. What's coming is the Republican-controlled Congress now is going to resurrect George W. Bush domestic and military foreign policies. Oh, they'll come under a little bit different form and name, but it's going to be the same thing. What are these policies, these repeat policies, old wine in new bottles, as they say? Well, I'm going to give you 10 of them to watch for right now. We're going to talk about them next week. One, big-time corporate tax cuts coming. Yeah, and they'll really agree on that because Obama's already on record cutting corporate tax rate. And they're all lying about the fact that corporations in the U.S. pay 35% tax rate, more than any other country in the world. Well, not true, because what counts is the effective tax rate. What are they really paying after all the loopholes and changes? Well, they're paying about 12%. So we'll talk about that next week. Excuse me. That's the first thing coming. The other big thing coming right away is free trade. Trans-Pacific Partnership, that once again Obama and Republicans are really, as in corporate tax cuts, on the same page and agreeing. So that's coming. Third, the XL pipeline is coming. Yes, now they will approve XL, I believe, and Democrats will cave in on that. It'll become a bargaining chip. Obama may attempt to strike a deal with Republicans, let the XL pipeline go through, but let's continue with the EPA limitations on industrial plant emissions. But you'll see McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, now head of the Senate, will never agree on that because that means in his home state the coal companies will have less business. And he'll never agree on that. But Obama will try to make the trade, but he will fail, as he has done on so many attempts to bargain with Republicans. Fourth, Medicaid. Medicaid. They're going to go after Medicaid. Already, many states refuse to participate in Medicaid. And they're going to look for other reasons to chip away at Medicaid. Third, the Affordable Care Act. They're going to chip away at the Affordable Care Act in significant ways. They're waiting on a Supreme Court decision that gives them the opening and where they'll go. But, you know, they'll repeal the medical device tax, which funds a good part of it. In other words, medical instrument companies have had to pay because they benefit greatly from Obamacare, but they don't want to pay. Anyway, they'll exempt them, and they'll exempt more small businesses, which are already suspended from participating for another year, and they'll turn that into a permanent thing. All these examples will destroy the funding base for ACA, and the result will be it won't perform, and by 2016 they'll have a good excuse to say, see, it's not working, let's get rid of it. That's what they do, you know. They, if they can't get rid of it initially, a bill or a law, what they do is defund it, defang it, and then they pull the plug on it because they say, oh, it's not working. All right, immigration. This is going to be interesting. Indications are Obama's going to issue his executive order. And it's really pissing off the Republicans in Congress. Their idea of immigration reform is border security and more deportations. It'd be interesting to see what happens there. I suspect that President Obama will issue some kind of a tepid executive order, and then it'll become a bargaining chip with them over an immigration bill. Next, number seven. Ukraine funding. The Ukrainian coup government that the U.S. set up after using NGOs to destabilize its elected government, what they're going to do now is provide more military support and funding for the Ukraine U.S. government, its puppet government over there. And now that the war is picking up again in eastern Ukraine, that'll be the justification. Oh, ISIL in Syria. More funding there. Even troops on the ground. Back to Iraq. And that will be another number eight big push. Financial regulation, the Dodd-Frank bill. Oh, they'll chip away at that even more than they have been. It's the financial regulation, the law passed in 2010. They've been chipping away left and right on all these provisions. There really is no financial banking regulation to speak of anymore. And, you know, that's the roadway to the next financial crisis in the U.S., which is coming before the end of the decade, no doubt. So they'll pick away more on Dodd-Frank, pick it apart. So that's nine, and number 10 will be a new offensive at the state level, you'll see. Now that folks like Walker got reelected, and Kasich, right-winger in Ohio, and they want even more Republican governor positions, Republicans. So what you'll see is a resurgence of the right to work. In other words, make union membership illegal, totally voluntary. Okay. Unions can't require people that they negotiate for and improve their wages to at least pay union dues. So that's what right to work is all about, the open shop, and it's already making inroads elsewhere over recent years, and that will step up. Okay, so those are the 10 big deals. That's the wake of the midterms. That's the legacy of the midterms. And that's what's coming. And we'll talk more about that in more detail next week as that picture becomes clearer, particularly on immigration. So tune in next week and we'll talk about, in the wake of the midterms, what's coming, the new Back to the Future Republican policy offensive. All right, let's get back to our original topic here. And that topic is austerity. You've heard about austerity time and time again, right? In the U.S., people have written books and articles and so forth. Paul Krugman in his New York Times column talks about it repeatedly, scratches his head. He's perplexed. As the hybrid Keynesian that he is, he wonders what the hell's going on with these policy makers. Why are they engaging in austerity? It doesn't work. It's holding back the recovery in the U.S. It's causing Europe to descend into its third recession. Now, what's going on? He can't believe that this is happening, you know? After all, you know, it's fiscal policy and it's a drag on the economy. What's the matter with these folks, he's saying? He doesn't understand what it's really about. Austerity is necessary for capitalist policymakers to implement their version of economic recovery, which is a version totally dependent upon massive money, liquid money injections into the banks and into the system. That's what they want. They want monetary policy. They want and have been implementing for 6 years now monetary policy, central bank liquidity injections, bail out the banking system first, in the hopes that the banking system will then lend to businesses, bail out the rest of the businesses, and by the way, give them tax cuts at the same time, business tax cuts. We talked about that. So big tax cuts for businesses, particularly multinational businesses, and massive money injections into the banks will theoretically lead to the banks lending money to businesses that businesses now, with more cash, will use to invest and expand. And by expanding, they will hire more people. More people will have incomes. More income means more consumption. Consumption, 70% of the economy. Therefore, the economy will eventually recover. That's the strategy. That's the primary objective. And you see this all across the world in all the capitalist economies. Monetary policy first. Monetary policy first. Monetary policy. Get all this money into the hands of bankers and investors. I mean big-time investors, hedge funds and equity firms and no folks, right? Bail them out first in the hopes that they'll then spend a little bit, lend a little bit, and prime the pump for the rest of the economy. Well, this is supply-side economics. In other words, who supplies the goods and services? It's businesses in a capitalist economy. So we need to get them to expand. And then the rest of us sort of come along a little bit now and then, etc. That's the whole strategy. What they don't want to do is put money in the hands of workers and households and consumers first. They don't want to bail out Main Street first, because that's the other way you could do it, you know? Put the money in the hands of households and consumers. They start spending it. Because they spend it, they buy goods and services. Businesses see the goods and services being bought, i.e. demand, so then they invest and they expand businesses. Invest and expand. Hire more people, even more income. So now you got an upward spiral, right? That's what's called demand-side stimulus. That's what Paul Krugman and company and Keynesians, neo-Keynesians, say that's what we should be doing. You know, why are we doing it the opposite? Why are we putting money in the hands of the bankers first and their big multinational corporate cousins first, and then it spills down to smaller businesses next, and then last it goes to workers and households and consumers? That's the way they want to do it. That's the way capitalist policymakers prefer to do it, monetary policy first. That would then lead to supply-side investment second, and then to demand-side income consumption last. Well, what Paul Krugman wants to do is reverse that. Because you know what happens? Recovery happens quicker when you reverse it. In other words, give the money, pump the money into households and consumers and workers, who then buy the goods that stimulate the investment, etc., etc. Paul scratches his head and says, well, I don't understand why they don't do this, because it works better that way. Well, Paul, it has to do with classes in America and in the world. These policymakers who are owned lock, stock, and barrel, they want to bail out their buddies first and hope the rest occur. They don't want to bail us out first, just the opposite. Just the opposite. Well, why? Because, you know, their buddies put them in office. They pay for their election bills. Or if you're a Federal Reserve chairman, like Ben Bernanke, you get compensated nicely after your job is done. Yes. You know, Ben was, for 8 years here, since 2006, an employee of the Federal Reserve. You know, made several hundred thousand dollars. I don't know what his salary was, maybe $200,000-$300,000. Okay, not chump change, but, you know, not going to become a billionaire on that. Ah, but now that Ben has left, Ben is on the speaking circuit. And you know how much money he gets for a speech to bankers and big businesses? Between $200,000 and $250,000 per speech. That's how they reward their friends, when they do a good job for them while they're in office. You see, that's the American way of corruption. You know, it's not like in Mexico where you got to pay them more dita, right? And they get it up front. Now you get even more back-ended in revolving doors, as they say, as the door revolves and you leave government and you did a good job for your capitalist buddies and now you're going to get rewarded for it. Yeah, I mean, maybe the most extreme version of that was Ronald Reagan. When Reagan left office, he got $6 million for one speech. I mean, it was so blatant, though, they had to have him speak in Tokyo. They couldn't do it here. That way they would avoid all the press attention. So he got $6 million as soon as he left office in his first speech. All right, that's how it's done. Okay? The point is, monetary policy comes first. Bail out the banks first. And boy, did we bail out the banks in this country. We spent somewhere between 10 and 15 trillion minimum to bail out the banks in the last 6 years. In other words, we bailed them out way more than they needed. I mean, it was such a golden goose. No one wanted to stop it laying the eggs. And it's not just the bankers, but it's big private investors, hedge funds and so forth, and individuals who were holding all those trillions of dollars of toxic, worthless subprime mortgages and other bonds and asset-backed securities and so forth. Well, the Fed just printed the money and bought that junk from all of them. $4.5 trillion so far. They just ended that junk buying because there's so much junk and so much money out there now in the hands of all these investors that they don't know what to do with it. And it's causing financial bubbles everywhere around the world, you know, foreign exchange bubbles, Chinese property bubbles. You know, it just sloshes around. There's so much out there. And by the way, the central banks in the UK, the Bank of England and the Bank of Japan, they did the same thing, are doing the same thing in Japan. Still, another big QE, quantitative easing. That's where they buy up the bad assets, right? How do they get the other money into the bank, the other $10 trillion or so? Oh, well, that's zero interest rate. If you're a bank, you can go borrow from the Central Reserve for between one-tenth, 0.75%. But on the market, you can borrow federal funds, which is determined by the Federal Reserve, for one-tenth of 1%. And then if you leave your money with the Federal Reserve after you borrowed it, the Federal Reserve will pay you more than you have to pay it to borrow. Yes. So you borrow money on paper. You don't take it. You leave it there with the Federal Reserve, and they pay you. They pay you for not taking the money you borrowed, you, the banker, borrowed from them. I mean, isn't that crazy? Yeah, but boy, it sure fattens the balance sheets of the bankers. In the meantime, 6 years that's been going on. Okay, monetary policy comes first. That's the preferred solution. And it comes in the forms of quantitative easing, zero interest rate loans to bankers, and special auctions that they've discontinued. That's a way of really getting out their real money out there real quick. And then this thing called forward guidance, in which the Fed signals all the bankers what it's going to do next so they can all line up. Yeah, that's monetary policy. And all the central banks are doing it, led by the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, globally. They're online. You know, back in 2008, Federal Reserve got together with the Bank of England and all the other central banks and said, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to take the lead. We're going to loan you, Europe, private and central banks, we're going to loan you $1 trillion. Yeah, we gave $1 trillion to European banks. Federal Reserve gave $1 trillion for free. And how much did they give for 14 million homeowners who lost their homes or underwater? In the U.S., $50 billion, half of which went to the banks themselves as a bribe to try to get them to lower their interest rates. So, you know, maybe $5, $6 billion actually went to homeowners who were, you know, illegally thrown out of their homes sometimes. That was that robo-signing scandal that Obama did nothing about, turned it over to state attorneys general. And when the attorneys general at the states were doing something, he stepped in and then cut a deal favorable to the banks. They take care of their own. They're all the same. They're of the same class. Okay, so the point is, monetary policy is key. So where does that leave austerity? Right? And what exactly is austerity? What are austerity programs? Well, austerity programs have to do with what's called fiscal policy. Fiscal policy is about taxing, about government spending, about government actions to do something about deficits and the debt. All right, that's fiscal policy. But austerity is always associated with a certain kind of fiscal policy, which is about cutting government spending and tax cuts for big corporations while they raise taxes on the rest of us. Okay, you hear about the taxes they raise on the rest of us, but you don't hear as much about the tax cuts that they're giving to corporations and investors in the meantime. So there's a tax cut element for business tax cuts in austerity policy, but the big thing is the government spending. Oh, but it's not cutting government spending on all spending. It's cutting government spending on social programs and government investment. It's not about cutting spending on defense, you see. So it's selective fiscal policy. Austerity is of a certain kind. Reducing government spending on programs and investment, reducing government subsidies. In some places in the world, you know, they provide significant subsidies for ultra-poor workers, you know, so they can travel to work on public public transport system, buses and so forth, are subsidies for ultra-poor, you know, like in some places in Latin America, so they can buy staples, you know, like tortillas and stuff like that, you know, to survive. You know, you got to have the workers survive. You got to let them get to work, right? So some of these countries, you know, they have these subsidies, and they have transfer payments, you know, to the working poor, to the unemployed, to the elderly. Austerity means we're going to cut all of that. We're going to cut all of those subsidies. A good example of subsidies is in the Ukraine. For years, until recently, Ukrainians had the cost of their natural gas subsidized. In other words, they only paid one-eighth of the actual cost. The government paid the other seven-eighths. That's coming to an end here in a couple months. We'll talk about that shortly. Okay, so cutting government spending on all of these social programs and basic needs of the general public is part of what we call austerity. And cutting taxes on corporations is also part of austerity, although it's not so austere for them, is it? No, it's just the opposite. But austerity is more than that. Austerity means mass sales of government-owned properties and public assets. In other words, privatization of what was once owned by the government itself. And sometimes, in some countries, that includes factories, productions, national airlines, national steel operations, and so forth, right? Get rid of all that. Sell it off to private investors, mostly from Europe and the U.S., by the way. So austerity means selling off, privatizing at fire sale prices. In other words, at prices that are way below market, the market value. So these investors pick up these great assets at super cheap cost. And then they turn around and they raise the prices that they charge the public for them. It's no longer public. It's no longer free, like parks and so forth. You know, now you got to pay more for it. It's privatizing them. And they raise prices. So they make a killing in capital gains from the get-go by getting it below market prices, and then they just gouge the public since they privatized it going forward. Now we see that here in the U.S., you know, roads that were public in lots of places like California. Now they're beginning to squeeze us. Now you got to pay to drive. You know, if you want to sit in the long traffic jam, okay, you don't pay. But if you want to go in the fast lane, you've got to pay for it. And they keep jacking up prices on bridge tolls and so forth. You know, that's all part of the privatization. In the Eurozone, countries like Greece, Spain, and others in the Euro periphery had engaged in the last 5-6 years in massive below-market value sales of their public goods and investments, right, to cut their deficit and their debt. In the UK, you know, they're selling off parts of the national health insurance to do the same. In the U.S., selling a public access to roads, parks, and so forth, right? And austerity policies are never static. They're always evolving into new forms. Now the latest thing that's beginning to emerge, particularly in Europe, is called structural economic reforms and labor market reforms, as they call them. In Japan, too. What is this? Well, this is just another way of reducing business costs, primarily, if it's labor market reforms, in getting rid of pension costs, lowering wages for you know, the workforce in various ways, making workers work faster and harder to keep their jobs, i.e. increase productivity, which increases business profits, weaken and eliminate unions so they don't ask for more wages, change labor laws and practices and protections, so workers feel even less secure and willing to go along with all kinds of nasty things that are being done to them. That, too, is austerity. So government spending cuts, to sum up, privatization, sell-off of assets, labor market, structural reforms, most recent form of all this. This is all austerity. And it's all designed to keep down the deficit and the debt while recovery is attempted by means of monetary policy. You see, they know monetary policy is a slow, uneven, intermittent, insecure road to recovery. It takes a long time to generate a recovery by the use of monetary policy, except, of course, for the bankers and the corporations and investors. Then it's immediate, you see. Immediate. The government and the central bank just dumps all this money into their bag and fills it up again. The black hole that they created with all their losses from all their speculation, government immediately fills that up, so they recover right away. But the rest of us recover very, very slowly, if at all. You know, we have double and triple dip recessions, as in Europe and Japan, that continues to go on, despite trillions of dollars of money injection in the U.S., because we are the grand economic imperial power, and we have the global currency in the U.S., you know, it's not as bad. Why? Because we control the currency, global currency, the dollar, and we can export some of our economic problems to these other countries. I won't go into the means by which that occurs, but, you know, the dollar means we can do that. We have the global currency. And therefore, our recovery is way below market, historical standards, way below. You know, we only grow 1.5 to 2% per year for 6 years. That's how we're growing, which is about half of the normal rate. Now, at some times, the U.S. grows at the normal rate. There's a surge, right? We grow 3 to 4% for a couple quarters, and then we relapse. We go back down. Sometimes the zero or negative growth rates. 3 times in the last 5 years, we've hit a zero negative growth rate. Not a recession, but a severe economic relapse. And then we bounce back, you know, to 2-3%, and we've been doing that, bouncing along the bottom in the U.S., just above, you know, when you add it all up, net it all out after 6 years, just above normal growth rates, at zero growth rates. Europe, they're zero or less, same with Japan. And that's the way the whole global economy in the advanced economies of Europe, North America and Japan have been performing for 6 years now. Right? Repeated double, triple dip recessions in the worst cases and relapses in the best cases, like the U.S. But no real recovery, except for bankers and wealthy investors in the big corporations. They're the ones who clearly recover very fast. They love monetary policy. They love it. And now why austerity, then, when it doesn't really work in terms of stimulating the economy? Well, it's not supposed to work to stimulate the economy. That's a false notion that Krugman and company have, that the capitalists introduce austerity because the capitalists believe that's going to stimulate recovery. They don't believe that. They know it won't. So why do they continue with austerity? They continue with austerity because it's necessary for them, for their interest, to hold the line while their slow monetary policy does not quickly enough generate an economic recovery. They know that monetary policy is going to be slow recovery, intermittent for the rest of us, with relapses and recessions, and that can go on 5 or 10 years, sometimes more. You know, that becomes the new normal. Monetary policy generates very, very slow recovery, except for the very top, and it takes a long time. And in that interim of the long time, the economy is not performing very well. Therefore, government tax revenues are not fully recovering. And by the way, we're giving tax cuts for companies and investors anyway in the process as an appendage to the monetary policy. So we have this very slow growth and collapsing revenues. And that means that the government debt is going to rise unless we have austerity. And that's why they impose austerity, to make the rest of us pay for the rising government debt, because the monetary policy does not generate recovery quick enough. So you see, austerity works fine from the perspective of their class interests. It works for them. Doesn't work for us. And Paul Krugman's got it all confused as to who it's supposed to work for and why it continues. Well, austerity policies continue because the recovery is not robust, which they expect it not to be. That's why they continue. It's a complement. Austerity policies are a necessary complement to this primary monetary policy recovery focus that goes very slow. So they're necessary. And they do. It does work. Austerity does work for their class interests. Keep the lid on deficits and the debt by all these cuts, because we know it's not going to recover real fast. It may take 5, 10 years or more, the new normal, as they call it. Right? In the meantime, we're all recovered, we bankers and investors, you know, ASAP, within 12 months. And we go on to even greater heights. And we take our money and we invest it in stocks and bonds, and we get bubbles in the junk bond market and bubbles in the stock market. And every time you watch the stock market, Dow Jones in the United States, you know, it tries to correct. It goes down, there's a crisis somewhere, and it declines about 5, 6%. But it can't get to a normal correction of 10%. Why? Because there is so much money on the sidelines. These investors, institutional and not, what I call the global money parade, shadow bankers and everything, they got so much money that whenever, and they're chasing yield, you know, interest rates, yield, and they move their money around so fast, when they see a 5-6% drop in the Dow, they throw the money in and back up goes the Dow. We never get a real correction. Oh, but you know what that means? That means when we do get the correction, it'll be far worse than otherwise. And it's coming. It's coming, no doubt. Okay, so that's the relationship of austerity and why it's necessary. You know, and if you read the New York Times, let me just, I got a section here from my latest article on Telesur. I write the regularly several times a month for Telesur TV, which is a Latin American media outlet now, as a regular writer for them. And my latest article there is Why Austerity When It Clearly Doesn't Work, explaining this. And, you know, when I take on and talk to Paul Krugman and the others, that you just don't understand it because as liberals you don't understand the class origins of this policy. You know, it's the definition of a liberal, really does not want to look at the class perspective in all of this. Looks at it from a moral point of view. Oh, insufficient wages are immoral. Well, of course they are, but that doesn't explain why we have it and who benefits from it. Okay, in a relatively recent piece in his column, and by the way, I agree with a lot of what Paul says. Don't get me wrong, I'm not anti Paul Krugman, but I'm tired of reading these columns by these liberals where they talk about the problem, but they offer no real solutions to it. No, they can't, because their editors won't let them. And because if they did, they would have to implicate the Democrats as much as the Republicans, and they have all friends and buddies and connections there, so they're not going to do that. So what you get is this classic muckraking by American, quote, liberals and even progressives without any real solutions, because the solution means you got to talk about class, and they don't want to do that. Okay, so in one of his more recent New York Times columns criticizing austerity policies, it was called Revenge of the Unforgiven, Krugman notes that, quote, the world economy appears to be stumbling and that growth is stalling and the specter of deflation looms. Well, sure. No doubt. Don't disagree with that. But for Paul, austerity policies are one of the big causes of this global slowdown. Yeah, of course. Krugman condemns austerity and he asks, quote, why do governments keep making these mistakes? Why do they keep making the same mistakes year after year? Well, I addressed why. Because they want it. Because it's a necessary complement to monetary policy, the primary solution. In other words, bail out banks and the rich first, and maybe the rest of us will come along instead of bailing the rest of us out, and then maybe the banks and businesses will eventually come along. Okay. But Paul says the reason why they continue these austerity policies is because it's an error on their part. It's bad economic judgment, and it's a moral failure on the part of policymakers. Moral failure. Due to a, quote, excess of virtue, righteousness is killing the world economy, unquote, according to Paul. What does he mean by that? Well, virtue and righteousness. He points to Germany. He's a German basher, by the way. In other words, these foreigners are really the cause of our problems here, not our own capitalists. Sounds a little bit like Herbert Hoover back in the early 30s, who kept blaming the Europeans for the Depression. Anyway, Paul blames the Germans, saying these Germans are acting too virtuously. They're too righteous, self-righteous, and they have all this moral indignation towards debtors who refuse to pay their bills. And therefore, Germany keeps blocking efforts to stop austerity, because Germans are saying, German bankers, he means, are saying, you got to pay up your bills, folks. You know, and that means you've got to tighten your belts. That means austerity is for you. And that's what, you know, is the cause. It's a moral argument. It's a too virtuous. It's, you know, the Germans act too righteous. They ought to just let people stop paying these debts for a while and stimulate their economies. That's what his view is. So it's a moral problem. Well, it doesn't tell you anything to say it's a moral problem. You know, liberals love to fall into the pit of moral analysis, because that means they don't have to do the hard analysis that points fingers at their friends. Okay, so you can find this kind of attitude repeated. Martin Wolf, lead editorialist for the British Global Financial Times. Same thing, you know, austerity and in the UK, It was a blunder, a huge mistake. No, it wasn't a blunder. They knew exactly what they were doing, right? And it's worse than a crime. People who do it are stupid and wicked, i.e. moral arguments. Lead you nowhere. Moral explanations are not economic explanations. Lead you nowhere. And then there's in the Wall Street Journal, Alan Blinder, former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve in the USA, also declared that Eurozone austerity policy was due to a mistake. And again, it's the German obsession with austerity that is holding back Europe. Germany is the bogeyman here once again, and it's standing in the way of that heroic European Central Bank chairman Mario Draghi, pumping more QE into the European economy that would lead to recovery, according to monetarists and central bankers, of which Alan was one and is one. If only we would let poor Mario Draghi do his job. Right? But it's that German Central Bank president, Jens Weidmann, who, quote, won't budge. Explanations of why austerity originated, why it continues, that are based on moral arguments, or that all this was just a mistake, an error of judgment, tell us nothing about the origins and reasons for austerity policy, why it continues today after more than 5 years, and why it continues to morph into new forms like labor market reform and structural reforms. Liberals like Krugman and others are asking the wrong question. They're only asking half the right question. You know, when they say austerity doesn't work, the sentence is incomplete. They should be asking, doesn't work for whom? And who does it work for? Well, it works for bankers. It's necessary. It's the other side of the coin, the necessary complement for the low economic growth that occurs because their primary solution is monetary policy, i.e. quantitative easing, zero interest loans to bankers, and so forth. Pump the money into the bankers, and they will lend. Well, we pump trillions, and they're dribbling out the lending, except for their big multinational friends who are investing abroad. They're lending to them, but that doesn't do anything for the U.S. economy, see? That money just goes out of the U.S. Or they invest themselves in all these financial security markets in the U.S. and elsewhere, which does nothing for real job creation and real income growth. Look, if you look at the jobs that have been created in this country in the last 6 years, yeah, there's been 6 million created, three-fourths of which are part-time temp contingent jobs. And that was low-pay jobs without, you know, jobs in retail and jobs in restaurants and places like that. It's not jobs that are full-time permanent jobs. It's not union jobs. We created 6 million, but union numbers go down. And what about the 8 million who have left the labor force altogether? We haven't created jobs. We've churned the jobs. We've churned them. As people have come into the labor market, other people have left about the same numbers. Right? And we've churned from permanent to part-time contingent. And we're churning from union to non-union and high wage to low wage. Now the biggest, you know, hot thing is, well, there's wages, you know, and wages aren't rising. Well, of course they're not rising if you're hiring part-time temp people. Of course not. And even, in the services, you know, besides traditional contingent labor, I mean, in retail and lodging and hospitality, there's almost no permanent jobs anymore, full-time permanent jobs. But even in education, universities and colleges now, 75% of all the people who are teaching in colleges and universities are contingent. They're lecturers and they're adjuncts. No benefits, half pay, no security. And we're going to have a show on that pretty soon as well. All of them are engaging this. Austerity. It's more blatant. It's most blatant in Europe. You can see it in the Eurozone. But, you know, we're engaging in austerity in this country, too. We've done labor market reform here quietly, and that is all this contingent work. That's a labor market reform you can talk about. And, you know, we've cut taxes for the rich and corporations while we've raised taxes and fees, especially locally, for the rest of us. That's austerity. You know, we're privatizing everything left and right. Look, Obamacare is about privatizing the health care system. Obama's doing what George Bush couldn't do with his health savings accounts. That's what Obamacare is. You get people out of even the union employer negotiated plans. You know, tax those plans 40% in 2018 and destroy that. Make everybody go on exchanges. Oh, yeah, we're all going to go on the exchanges here eventually, and we're going to exempt businesses from. So we're going to end up paying the full boat for private insurance. And in the meantime, all of our forms of collective insurance are going to be destroyed. You know, then it's Medicare. Medicare is going to be the next big target. But they're going to have to Medicaid first before that. Okay. So it's going, austerity takes different forms, different places. It's going on here in the U.S. And what's going on in Japan? What form is Japan? Well, Japan introduced this huge quantitative easing thing 18 months ago, boosted their stock market, the rich got rich, and then it just totally collapsed. The economy fell 7% in the second quarter of this year, largely because they raised taxes on the rest of the folks. They raised their, almost doubled their sales tax. And the economy came to a total halt. And now they're talking about doing even more and more QE. Double down, you know. If it doesn't work, double down. And that's what they do in Japan. So, you know, all the advanced capitalist countries are doing the same thing. And they're still committed to monetary policy as the primary form of recovery, which means, as recovery doesn't happen, they will remain to be committed to austerity policy for the rest of us. Even though that austerity policy takes different shapes and forms. Austerity is about keeping the lid on rising government deficits and debt, making the rest of us pay for that debt, while waiting for monetary policy to restart financial markets and for the capitalist market system at subsequent point to eventually generate growth on its own. They believe if you wait long enough, it will come back. In the meantime, let's make our rich folks richer and whole, recover, and wait for it to slowly come back for the rest of us. That's their strategy in a nutshell. And to do that, monetary policy comes first, and austerity is a complement to it. Capitalists believe that the market will correct itself in the longer run. Government is to bail them out in the short run, and the market is for the rest of us in the long run. You see, that was exactly the same thing during the Depression, the same philosophy and strategy. Then it was called liquidationists. You know, the capitalists and Andrew Mellon, Treasury, government of Hoover, and so forth, you know, they said, liquidate, liquidate. In other words, let everybody lose their pants. And all the dead wood would get cleaned out, and then all the remaining would get even richer, and everything would recover itself. They believe that it's a little more, under a little bit more cover today, but that's essentially their philosophy. And it still is the case. Austerity policies work for them. And they're not an error. They're not a question of a moral failing. No. They are part of their class policy. They're the other side of the coin of monetary policy, which is the prime policy for recovery. Austerity is about making the general populace and the working classes pay for the monetary policy strategy's slow, often interrupted, and limited effect on generating economic recovery. So it hasn't failed. Now, if you really want to see these kind of policies in their extreme form, just look at the Ukraine today. I've written several articles on this over the last 6 months, one that goes back to March 28th. If you read the Counterpunch blog, take a look at my article March 28th there, weekend edition of Counterpunch, called Ukraine's IMF Deal. Okay, Ukraine, the U.S. Instigates a coup back in February, to suck the Ukraine into its economic orbit and deal the Russians a blow there, weaken them even more economically, which has been a long-term policy ever since 1991, as it militarily expands NATO at the same time. So they saw this opportunity in the Ukraine, and they helped generate a coup on the ground. You know, we've been financing these NGOs, non-government organizations, many of which were proto-fascist, for two decades now. The U.S. almost got away with doing it with the Orange Revolution, so-called, in 2005, but that ended up in a compromise between pro-Russian and pro-U.S. Politicians and oligarchs, meaning billionaires, both of whom were ripping off Ukraine and have been now since 2005, even before that, you know. And Ukrainian people are, of course, upset about both of them. But anyway, the U.S. and its folks, you know, its billionaires, its oligarchs, and its control of these ground forces precipitated a coup last February, and as a result, opened up the door for the IMF, International Monetary Fund, to come in and to start taking over and managing the Ukrainian economy. You see, the U.S. steps in and takes over the foreign policy, and the IMF steps in and helps the bankers close on its heels to take over the domestic economy in the Ukraine. And that's exactly what began to happen. The IMF came up with a $17 billion bailout bill. You know, it had previously issued a bailout bill in 2005, but as I said, that ended up in a compromise. Now they wanted to break the compromise and really gain control of the Ukraine. And the IMF comes in April with the $17 billion bailout. And it says, okay, you know, we're going to have to impose austerity on the economy in order to do all these structural reforms. And, that's going to end up, IMF says, you know, with the economy declining maybe 5% over the next 2 years, minimal, and then things would get better in 2015. It'll grow 5%, and actually 4.6. And that will mean, we'll make up the loss. Well, I wrote in this Counterpunch article that was nonsense, that it was going to take $50 billion to bail out the Ukraine, and that the economy would collapse between 10 and 15% in the meantime. You know, not that 5%, but 15%, which is depression, which is a Greece-like depression. Just what they did, IMF, to Greece, you know, they're going to do and are doing to the Ukraine, maybe even worse. Okay. And the IMF said, this will improve the currency, Ukrainian currency, which was collapsing, and this will improve exports. There might be a little inflation because we're going to end all the subsidies to folks for that natural gas, and we're going to make the national natural gas company, Naftogaz, more efficient. Now, as a preliminary, I'm sure, to selling it off. And the central bank, you know, will need some money to buy the currency to keep it from falling too much, but we'll let it fall. This is all IMF stuff I'm talking about, right? Make a flexible exchange rate. We'll end the gas subsidies, as I said. Gas prices will rise and, you know, maybe 50% this year and by 79% next year. Next year being 2015. And we're going to have to cut government spending, get rid of government jobs, cut wages, cut pensions for everybody, right? And sales tax hikes. In other words, this is all austerity, isn't it? Sell off assets, you know, make the people pay for the budget deficits, take away their subsidies and their programs and their government spending and their safety net, but create a situation where it's great for foreign investors to come in and buy up at fire sale prices, not only government assets, but other companies, and solidify, take over the economy of the Ukraine. Well, that's what was done over the last 6 months. Oh, but it's not quite working, you see, because their estimate of 5% decline in GDP this year was revised in July to 6.5, and then in August to 7.3, and then most recently to 8% collapse of the economy. Its currency has fallen 36% against the dollar, the worst in the world. Okay, its deficits and debts are rising, not falling. Its exports and imports are both falling. No one in his right mind business is going to invest in that place right now. So everything is getting worse. Much worse. Oh, but you know, they're blaming it on the war in the East. Well, that's having some effect, but it's really the IMF program itself that is having that big depressing effect on the economy. Foreign reserves that are needed by the central bank to finance exports and to keep the private banks going fell $4 billion alone last month. It's down to only $12 billion. Right? No wonder the currency's collapsing and will continue to collapse. And of that $17 billion, the IMF has disbursed only $4.5 billion. And virtually all of that has gone to pay principal and interest on previous loans to Western banks, and some of that is now going to pay the gas bill to Russia before the winter comes, or they'll have no gas. So, you know, no money is really going into Ukraine to help the people from the IMF. It's going to bankers and investors and debtors. In the meantime, they're cutting the hell out of everything, spending and so forth, and insisting on fighting this war. And, you know, the President Poroshenko recently made a tour of the West, including Washington, hat in hand, saying, "More money, please." Mm? And according to Washington Post, gave, quote, the speech of his life and got $53 million from the U.S. That funds the cost of the war in the East for about 9 days. And they need $50 billion. They've even admitted now, oh, we may need $19 billion more on top of the $17 billion. Well, that's 36. They're getting close to my 50. And that's the situation of how austerity works, led by the IMF in this case, in the Ukraine. Okay. That ought to do much of what needs to be said about austerity, its real reasons and its real role in the capitalist economy picture and its effects on classes, both positive and negative, depending what class you're in, right? Okay, again, next week, what we're going to do next week, we're going to take a deep look at this new Republican offensive, back to the future, back to George W. Bush, old wine in new bottles. Here we go again.